to Isla Mirada, where his mother would cook him dinner. But one Sunday in March of 1978, Huck said sure, and Coke said, "Finally! I've been wanting to introduce you to my sister." Huck remembers that he'd bristled. He did just fine in the women department on his own, and he'd been looking forward to a day of real fishing, instead of baiting clients' hooks and turning back early if someone got seasick. And he wasn't sure he'd enjoy the presence of anyone's sister, aside from his own, on a fishing trip. But then Kimberly came striding down the dock, wearing cut-off army surplus fatigues, a red bandana around her neck, and a white visor. Her sandy blonde hair was up in a ponytail. Huck recognized her as the bartender from Sloppy Joe's, the famous Key West watering hole where Hemingway used to hang out and where Huck liked to fish for women from time to time. Somehow he'd never realized that the most popular bartender in Key West was his crusty, hard-living boss's sister. Well, okay, Huck thought. She was nice to look at, but could she fish? Oh, yes. Like Huck, Kimberly was born and raised in the Keys, on and around boats. During that first trip together, Huck watched her land a 150-pound sailfish, sitting in the fighting chair, screaming like she was having a baby. He vowed then that he would marry her. But first he had to beat out scores of other men, the salty locals and rich sunburned tourists alike, all calling her name, throwing down money, telling her she was as beautiful as one of Charlie's angels. It took endurance to get the first date. Huck had to stay at the bar drinking but not getting drunk until Sloppy Joe's closed at 4 a.m. This was no small feat when his wake-up for the morning charter was only 2 hours later. Looking back, Huck realizes that he'd been so dazzled by Kimberly's obvious charms and, he'll just say it, so invigorated by the chase, that he ignored the warning signs of a deeply troubled person. Kimberly routinely did shots with customers, sometimes as many as 5 or 6. She never appeared visibly drunk at work, but after her shift ended, there was always a margarita or 3 or 5. Back at the beginning, Kimberly had been happy and pliably good-natured when she was drunk. Shortly after they were married, things changed. In year 3, Captain Coke's own substance abuse got the best of him. He was spending all his money on cocaine and, apparently, none on his business. He'd taken out a line of credit on the equity he had left in his boat and then failed to pay. Just as the bank was ready to claim the boat, Huck stepped in and bought not only the boat, but the whole charter business. Kimberly called Huck a savior, though she wanted Huck to keep Coke on as captain. No, sorry, that wasn't going to happen. Huck didn't want Coke anywhere near the boat or the business, though he was happy to pay for rehab. This went over poorly with both brother and sister, but Huck stood his ground. He took over the charter business, hired a new young mate, and made so much money the first year that he was able to buy a second boat. Huck wanted to start a family, and Kimberly claimed she did too, but she refused to quit her job at Sloppy Joe's. It brought in too much money, plus it was her identity. Huck didn't say that if she had a baby, she would have a new identity. He wouldn't dare. Kimberly did go off her birth control, but she continued with the shots and the after-shift drinking. "For God's sake, Kimmy," Huck finally said, "any baby we have will be born pickled." Kimberly didn't like this one bit, though it did make her slow down a little. And sure enough, she got pregnant. Huck remembers the mixture of giddiness and terror at the news. It was as though someone had told him he could travel to the moon with the astronauts, or star in a movie with Clint Eastwood. Did he want to? Hell yes. Did he really want to? He wasn't sure. What did Huck know about having a child, about being a father? He was also afraid that Kimberly wouldn't be able to stay on the wagon for 9 full months. It seemed impossible. Plus, both of them smoked like fiends, and that would have to stop. Kimberly bought prenatal vitamins and went to see an OBGYN in Miami, and she changed her post-shift drink to one white wine spritzer. She cut down to 4 cigarettes a day, breakfast, lunch, dinner, and late at night. And Huck thought, okay, maybe this will work. He couldn't expect her to quit everything cold turkey. That was how people failed. Then, late on the night of December 1st, 1983, Huck still remembers the date and probably always will. Kimberly came home stinking drunk, waking Huck up when she slammed into their bungalow on Catherine Street singing "Peace of My Heart" at the top of her lungs and crying. Huck jumped out of bed. He would never lay a hand on a woman, but he wanted to throttle her. He took her gently by the shoulders, pulled her in close, and whispered, "It's not just you anymore, Kimmy. You have to think about our baby." Kimberly said, "Baby's gone, Sam. I started bleeding at work." Huck was crushed. Kimberly was worse than crushed. She was riding a pendulum of emotions. When she swung one way, she was fine. It happened to a lot of people. They could try again. When she swung the other way, she was a mess. It was her fault. She was damaged and broken and unfit to be a mother. Kimberly went back on the pill. Huck felt like he was on a bike without brakes careening down a mountainside. He was afraid to jump off, even though he knew he would crash when he got to the bottom. What followed was 3 years of Huck fishing and Kimberly drinking, drinking, drinking. This ended only once a beefy, tattooed loudmouth on one of Huck's charters bragged to his buddy that he'd gotten to third base with the bartender of Sloppy Joe's the night before. "Oh, yeah?" Huck said, blood pulsing in his ears. "Blonde gal?" "Ass like a valentine," the loudmouth said, and it took every ounce of Huck's willpower not to stab the guy in the forehead with the gaff. When Huck confronted Kimberly, she admitted to it right away but said it was more like second base, maybe not even. She couldn't remember and wouldn't have been able to pick the guy out of a lineup. "The men are an occupational hazard, Sammy. They don't mean anything." "Men?" he said. And he realized then that Kimberly hooked up with her customers all the time, maybe even every night. Was the baby she lost even his? She had made him a laughingstock, an absolute fool for love. He told her it was rehab or he was leaving. She agreed to rehab, and once she was safely inside the facility, Huck served her with divorce papers, which broke her heart, but broke his heart even worse. Once Huck left the Keys for St. John, it was only a few weeks before he met and fell in love with Leanne Small, who was Kimberly's opposite in every way. Maya liked to throw around the word queen. "Beyoncé is a queen. J-Lo is a queen." But in Huck's life, there had been only one queen, and that was Leanne. She was statuesque, bronze-skinned, dark-eyed. She had a rich laugh and a slow smile that she shared with Huck like a secret. On their first real date at Chateau Bordeaux, Huck told Leanne about Kimberly. Leanne tisked him, because who couldn't have predicted how that story was going to end, and then said, "If you're looking for more crazy, you're in the wrong place." Leanne didn't fish, but she checked the wind, watched the sky, passed along fish sightings from their West Indian neighbors that Huck would never have heard about otherwise. She introduced Huck to the people at restaurants who would buy his catch. She never gave him a hard time about how long he spent on the water or tinkering on the boat. And man, could she cook. Conch ceviche, Creole fish stew, fresh tuna steaks with lime and toasted coconut. Leanne was tough, stubborn, uncompromising, but unlike Kimberly, she stuck to a moral code and was utterly beyond reproach. Huck was a little scared of her at times. She was a nurse practitioner and the most competent person up at the Myra Keating Smith Community Health Center, where she treated everything from ankles sprained on the Reef Bay Trail to jellyfish stings to STDs. Leanne was strict with Rosie, but despite this, or because of it, Rosie broke the rules again and again and again, eventually getting pregnant by one of the rich men she waited on at Keneal Bay. There were 6 golden years when Huck lived in the house on Jacob's Ladder with Leanne, Rosie, and Maya. He can remember sitting down to dinner in the evenings and seeing their bright faces and hearing their chatter or their squabbling and thinking how blessed he was to be among them. He missed that sweet spot in his life now that it was over. Leanne died of congestive heart failure. Rosie died in the helicopter crash with Russell Steele. Now here's Huck, 5 years after Leanne's passing and 1 month after Rosie's passing, in danger of falling in love with Irene Steele, the wife of Rosie's lover. As his friend Rupert would say, "You can't make this shit up." It comes as no surprise to Huck that the invisible man, Russell Steele, was just another Caribbean pirate. Evading taxes and laundering money were nearly as common down here as snorkeling and drinking rum. Irene has now lost the villa in Little Cinnamon, as well as her home in Iowa City, and the latter, Huck understands, is the greater loss by far. Most people down here are from somewhere else. They have another place they call home. It must feel pretty rotten to have that taken away, to be left with little more than the clothes on your back, the shoes on your feet. Irene isn't bankrupt. She has $20,000 in an account down here, money from her magazine job.
$20,000 isn't nothing, Huck says.
They're standing out on the deck of Huck's house, elbow to elbow on the railing but not touching, gazing out at the water and the faint outline of St. Croix in the distance. A lot of people would call them lucky. People in Iowa City whose cars were buried under 3 feet of snow, for example.
It's not enough to live on for very long, Irene says. Both you and I know that. I need to find a decent place to live with reasonable rent, and I'll need to buy a car.
Huck is relieved that she seems to be talking about staying on St. John, even though they both know that her money would last a lot longer if she lived almost anywhere else.
You can stay here as long as you want, Huck says.
This turn of events doesn't seem all that bad to him. He likes having her here. He likes being the person who can put a roof over her head and food on her plate, though he would never, ever reveal this to Irene. One trait all the women in his life have shared, they were born on the 4th of July. Independent. They were independent. Irene bows her head. Her hair is out of its braid. It's wavy and long as it falls around her face, a chestnut curtain shot through with strands of silver. When she looks up, she says, "I'm grateful for your friendship and the job on the boat."
"You're an asset on the boat, AC," he says. "I need you on the boat. Today alone was hell on me."
That morning, Huck had a Master of the Universe type on board. Guy in his early 40s, whirled by the balls, gung-ho, let's go, and his 4 sons. The older 3 were complete hellions from the second they stepped onto the boat, still in their basketball sneakers.
"Take your shoes off," Huck told them.
The oldest kid, maybe 15, said, "These are Cactus Jacks."
"Doesn't matter. Please take them off."
"It's Travis Scott's shoe," the kid said.
"This isn't Travis Scott's boat."
Huck said. He didn't admit that he had no idea who Travis Scott was. He hadn't paid attention to basketball since Jordan retired.
It's my boat, and you are to remove your shoes, please.
The youngest of the kids couldn't have been more than 5. He was too little to be out on the boat without a dedicated caretaker, which his father, whose sole focus was catching mahi, most certainly was not. The father mentioned that the mother was having a spa day at Keneal, and he admitted that he wasn't used to having the kids by himself. The father took the first fish. Huck hated when grown men did this, ahead of their own kids, in the name of, "Let me show you how it's done." And he also took the 4th fish, forgetting about son number 3, who was rightfully pissed off. Kid number 3 retaliated by grabbing his father's phone out of his pocket and dangling it over the side of the boat. This wasn't the first time Huck had seen this. It happened at least once a month, usually when Huck had a bachelor party on the boat. Guys got drunk and bent out of shape or were screwing around. But Huck had never seen anyone flip out the way the father flipped out. He roared so loudly that even Huck flinched, and when the father went to grab the phone from his son, it fell in the water.
You deserved that, buddy, Huck thought.
Chaos ensued. They had to stop the boat, get the diving mask and the bait net, and go fishing for the phone, which was most certainly resting on the seafloor 20 feet below. The littlest kid fell when no one was looking and got a bloody nose, but the father was only concerned about his phone. He couldn't live without it. Was there a store on this stupid little island where he could get it replaced that afternoon?
St. Thomas, Huck said,
his fists itching. It had been a terrible charter, and Huck was convinced that if Irene had been there, she would have established an order for the fish so that no one got overlooked, no one got angry, no one got hurt, and Huck didn't have to hear his home of the past 20 years insulted by a man-child. He wants to tell Irene this story and let her know what a joy it is to have a woman in his life who understands the particular texture of his days. But she's in no state to hear it. He'll save it for later. After all this has been resolved and they're back to normal. Will this be resolved? Will they be back to normal? I appreciate your generosity, but I can't impose on you forever, Irene says. Unfortunately, I have nowhere else to turn right now. I feel like such a burden.
You're not a burden, Huck says. Maya wants you here, and so do I.
He moves an inch closer, so that their elbows are kissing, and she doesn't move away. Huck wonders if he should hug her. He places an oh-so-tentative hand between her shoulder blades, and she snaps to attention, ramrod straight. Huck lets his hand drop. Okay, he gets it. No touching. This isn't a fairy tale where I'm a damsel in distress and you're the hero swooping in to save me.
I know it's not, AC, he says.
Please, she says, stop calling me that.
Okay,
Huck says, and now he's hurt. AC stands for Angler Cupcake, which, she'd told Huck, was what her father used to call her. Huck likes the nickname. It doesn't exactly suit her. Irene is too sensible and straightforward to be any kind of cupcake. But he likes that he has a nickname for her. It suggests intimacy, friendship, something special between the two of them. But fine, she wants him to stop, he'll stop.
I can't do this, Irene says. I told you last night that I need more time.
But that was before 10 FBI agents showed up to seize the villa, Huck thinks. That was before she learned her Iowa home was gone as well. Huck thought maybe that had changed things, but apparently not.
I promised I'd give you as much time as you need, he says, and I meant it.
Except now I'm living in your house, Irene says, mooching off you, taking advantage of your kindness. Don't you understand how confusing that is?
No, Huck says, I don't. We're friends, Irene, okay? And co-workers. If you want to keep it just friends and co-workers, I'm good with that. I'm not exactly inviting you to share my bedroom, am I?
But you want to, don't you? She asks.
Want to what?
Invite me to share your bedroom.
Huck can't figure out if his answer should be yes or no. The truth is yes. Should he be truthful? I want you to sleep where you're comfortable. You know my feelings for you, AC. Sorry, Irene. But I'm not interested in forcing this along.
He's so agitated that he lights a cigarette. This is the kind of conversation he likes the least. Murky, ambiguous. They're middle-aged. Why can't they just say what they mean?
If it moves forward, it will be when you're ready. I'm a patient man, Irene. I'm a fisherman.
This gets a smile, though one so fleeting that Huck wonders if he imagined it. I don't want to be a charity case, and I don't want to feel like I owe you something in exchange for...
Huck exhales a stream of smoke. Now he's offended. Please, Irene, give me some credit.
I do, but...
But you were married to a fella for 35 years who turned out to be a cheat and a liar and a criminal, Huck says. So I understand how maybe you're hesitant to trust the very next man you meet. But I promise. Irene, I promise you, on my precious granddaughter's life, that I am pure in my intentions and my feelings. I've been hurt before, too. Hurt badly.
Huck pauses. At some point, he'll tell her the story about Kimberly, and she'll understand they're more alike than she knows.
I'm not going to use kindness to leverage something from you. Do you understand me?
Yes.
Are we okay then? He
wants to ask. Irene steps toward him and puts her hands on his shoulders, then moves closer and clasps her hands behind his neck. She rests her head on his chest. Two things are apparent in that moment. One, they are okay. And two, Huck doesn't understand women. Irene's phone rings, snapping them back to reality. Happiness is a butterfly that lands and then just as quickly flies away. Irene answers the phone. Hello? There's a pause. Oh, Baker. Another pause. What? Where are you? Here? On St. John? She turns to Huck, her eyes wide with alarm, and mouths, He's here. Huck stubs out his cigarette. He imagines his buddy Rupert doing his best Chief Brody imitation.
Huck, my friend, you're going to need a bigger boat.
Heirs. Treasure Island has a blown power head. It needs to go all the way to Puerto Rico to be worked on, and won't be back in commission for a week. Ayers is relieved. As usual, she wakes up face down on her bed at the crack of dawn when her coffee maker starts gurgling. But Ayers can barely even lift her head. She has to go to the bathroom, but it's 10 feet away, which might as well be a country mile. Depression is setting in. Because of Mick. Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. After Maya called to tell Ayers that she saw Mick and Bridget kissing on the beach. They were all over each other. I saw it with my own two eyes. Ayers nearly smashed her phone against the tile floor of her apartment. But she was stopped by her pragmatism. It would take $750 and a trip to St. Thomas to replace it. And her skepticism. Maya must be mistaken. She'd thought it was Mick and Bridget, but it had to be another couple. Mick had proposed only 2 days before. He'd planned the whole thing, luring heirs out onto his boss's boat, Fun Day, rafting up in Christmas Cove near Pizza Pie among all their friends in the St. John service industry, asking Captain Stephen from the Singing Dog to play Southern Cross, which was Ayers' favorite song. My love is an anchor tied to you, tied with a silver chain. He'd proposed in front of everyone, but aside from that, Ayers couldn't have executed it better herself. And maybe part of her did appreciate the public nature of the proposal. All of their friends knew that Mick had cheated on Ayers with Bridget and had then dated Bridget for 2 months, 1 week, and 3 days. Yes, it was painful enough that Ayers kept track. So it was validating to have everyone bear witness to Mick's ultimate choice. It was Ayers. Ayers, not Bridget. Or so she'd thought. She wanted to dismiss what Maya had told her. Maya was only 12. Could she really be trusted? But Ayers trusted Maya more than anyone else she knew. Maya wouldn't have said it was Mick and Bridget unless it was Mick and Bridget. Ayers had to admit that Mick kissing Bridget on the beach wasn't out of the realm of possibility. She could only too easily imagine how it had unfolded. Bridget wanted closure. She needed to have a talk. She deserved at least that. And then she gazed at him a certain way, or she nudged her knee between his legs, or she stroked his earlobe. And Mick broke. Mick might have thought that since he'd proposed and would be with Ayers the rest of his life, he had one last pass. He did not have one last pass. Ayers had decided to verify Maya's sighting with a second source. She'd texted Lindsay, another server at the beach bar, someone she considered a friend, to ask if she'd noticed Mick and Bridget slip away during service. The response?
To be honest, yes. B stranded me tonight with all her tables for half an hour. She's been crying since Monday, and I assumed Mick was going to talk with her about it because it's been distracting for all of us. But they were gone an unusually long time, and when they came back, B looked much happier.
Ayers pulled the ring off her finger and nestled it back into its little velvet box. She wondered about the happy bride-to-be who would eventually wear it. She sent Mick a text.
I know you kissed Bridget. I'm leaving the ring in the box under the big rock at the end of my driveway.
Mick texted back. K.
K? Ayers thought. What kind of response was that? Didn't he want to know how Ayers had found out? Didn't he want to try and deny it? Wasn't he going to fight for her?
Apparently not. The engagement was over. It had lasted slightly more than 48 hours. Ayers should never have taken Mick back. Bridget was some kind of narcotic for him. She sent a second text.
Best of luck to you two.
She wanted to say something else, but "you deserve each other" was too cliché, and "just remember, once a slut, always a slut" seemed too mean. In the end, Ayers wrote, "Poor Gordon," because Ayers felt sorry for Mick's dog. She'd miss him. And then Ayers had texted Baker to let him know what was up.
Maya saw Mick kissing Bridget on the beach tonight. I'm giving the ring back.
Baker responded, "Can't wait to celebrate your newfound freedom."
Ayers is so tired. She's flattened. She lies in bed until 3:30, which is the last possible moment she can get up and make it to La Tapa on time. But she still can't muster the energy to move. She picks up her phone. There's no word from Mick, or from Baker either, for that matter. And calls La Tapa. Tilda answers.
"Till," Ayers says, "I can't make it in tonight. I know it's trash of me to bag on you so late, but honestly?"
Honestly, the mere idea of lifting trays, opening wine, remembering orders? Nope, it's beyond her today.
"Don't worry about it," Tilda says.
We have only 30 on the books. Besides, here, Tilda lowers her voice, we all know what happened with Mick.
You do?
Ayres says. She's not sure why she's surprised. It's a tiny island, the Coconut Telegraph and all that. Bridget is probably crowing about her triumph all around town. Ayres wonders if Mick came by to get the ring. Maybe he gave her ring to Bridget. He is just enough of a cheeseball to do exactly that.
Yeah, he's staging a sit-in at Cruise Bay Landing. Him and Gordon.
A what?
He's been at the bar at CBL since it opened this morning. He has the ring in front of him. He's stinking drunk, and he claims he's not moving until you take him back. Gordon is tied to his bar stool.
You're kidding me, Ayres says.
Not kidding. Saw it myself, Tilda says. I think AK is going to cut him off soon, but he might have to call the police to get Mick out of there.
Ayres is slightly revived by the news that Mick is staging a sit-in at Cruise Bay Landing, crying into his beer. So he is upset after all.
He gave me this whole song and dance about how Bridget was taking a new job at Island Abodes, something he arranged to get her away from him. And not 2 days later, they're making out on the beach. I don't care if he sits at CBL for the rest of his life. I don't care if he turns into petrified wood and moss grows on him and a bird builds a nest in his hair. I'm not taking him back.
Good girl, Tilda says. You're on the schedule Saturday night. I'll see you then?
Yes, Ayres says. Thanks, Till.
Thursday passes in a blur. Friday comes and Ayres doesn't feel any better. She feels worse. Dull, leaden, sluggish, and dizzy. Her coffee tastes sour. Food holds no appeal. She doesn't have to work at Latapa, but she's supposed to hang out with Maya in the afternoon. She can't imagine getting in her truck and driving to Gift Hill, much less doing some kind of fun, enriching activity. Waterlemon. They were supposed to snorkel at Waterlemon. If Ayres tried to snorkel, she would end up sleeping on the sandy floor of the Caribbean. She sends Maya a text, even though Maya is at school and technically not allowed to check her phone.
I can't pick you up, Nut. I'm sick.
2 seconds later, so much for the rules, there's a response.
It's okay, I'm grounded anyway. Plus, there's been drama at home.
Drama? Ayres texts. At home, meaning with Huck? This is unusual.
Too much to text, Maya says. Call me later.
Later is Saturday at noon. It takes everything Ayres has to get out of bed, take a shower, her hair is in the first stages of dreadlocks, and make herself eat a piece of toast at her tiny kitchen table. She fights to keep the toast down. Something is up with her. This isn't just emotional distress. After all, Ayres hiked the Reef Bay Trail only 2 days after Rosie died. Ayres checks her arms and legs, praying that she has overlooked some kind of weird bite or sting that would explain this. She'd gone backpacking all over the world with her parents when she was growing up, and she'd witnessed travelers in the throes of all kinds of exotic ailments. There was a pretty blonde college student doing a gap year in Nepal who nearly died of giardia. A couple of Israeli kids in India who had leishmaniasis that they thought they'd gotten from sand flies on Goa. And in Thailand, they'd met a family who had been infested with sea lice. Leptospirosis? A guy Ayres knows down here contracted that from cleaning palm rats out of traps. Ayres is making herself sicker just thinking about this. Stop thinking about it. She texts Maya.
You busy?
A second later, Ayres' phone rings. Her screen says Nut and lights up with a picture of Maya at carnival a few years ago. Her face painted royal blue and crimson.
Hi, Ayres says. What you doing?
Decorating my new room, Maya says. Or as Gramps calls it, Moving the mess.
New room? Are you...
Taking Mama's room, Maya says. I've slept in here the past 2 nights.
She pauses.
The sheets still smell like her. How long do you think that will last?
Ayers' heart feels like a dying rose shedding its petals.
Oh, nut, she says. I worry I'm going to make the smell disappear faster by sleeping in the bed, and that one night it won't smell like her, it will smell like me. But I don't have a choice because Irene is sleeping in my room.
Irene?
Yeah, Maya says. Have you not heard? Baker didn't call you?
Baker has not called her, which she finds strange, since he's supposedly so keen on celebrating her newfound freedom. But she figures he's been busy getting settled in, and frankly, she's relieved that he hasn't asked to see her.
No, Ayers says. Heard what?
Maya sighs like an adult.
Well, they lost the villa in Little Cinnamon.
This news propels Ayers out of her chair and over to the front window. It's another beautiful day in paradise. Things are happening out there while Ayers convalesces.
Lost the villa? What are you talking about? Gramps said it was tax trouble. But I heard him and Irene talking about the FBI. I think my dad was into something illegal.
Ayers' stomach lurches. She collapses onto the sofa. Hidden underneath it are all of Rosie's journals. Ayers had discovered the journals buried in Rosie's dresser and she'd absconded with them, taking them from Huck's house. They were Ayers' own private archaeological find, no less precious or revelatory to Ayers than the Dead Sea Scrolls or dinosaur bones. These journals told Rosie's story, one Ayers didn't know, and Ayers was Rosie's best friend. Ayers found herself compelled to binge on them, but she'd made herself read slowly and carefully. She'd made herself savor them. In the final 2 volumes are passages in which Rosie described Russ telling her outright back in 2016 that his company, Ascension, sold the lots in Little Cinnamon to fictional entities, shell companies. He admitted to Rosie that Ascension was in the business of hiding money, laundering money. And then, in the very last pages of the journal, Rosie wrote about how Russ had informed his boss, Todd Croft, that he was leaving the company, and how Todd Croft had shown up at La Tapa and threatened Rosie. 6 weeks later, both Russ and Rosie were dead. Now the FBI knows, and the villa is gone? Ayers' thoughts are all over the place. Do the FBI agents think Todd Croft killed Russ and Rosie, or do they think it was, in fact, a lightning strike? Ayers remembered hearing thunder that morning. So it was a lightning strike. Simple, impossible bad luck. But the scene Rosie described with Todd Croft was alarming. The villa is gone. Ayers can't help but wonder what this means for Baker. Obviously, if there's no place for him to live, then he's going back to Houston. Ayers feels a deep, crushing disappointment, worse even than her pain about the broken engagement. Baker will leave, if he even arrived in the first place. And what about Cash? Will he leave too? Ayers brings her mind back to the present.
So Irene is living with you guys?
She says.
For how long?
Until she gets back on her feet, Maya says.
She lowers her voice.
I think Gramps is happy. He cut my grounding down to 1 week.
Won't Irene go back to Iowa?
She can't, Maya says. The FBI took that house too.
You're kidding.
I told you, there's been drama.
What about Cash?
Ayers says. Because Treasure Island is out of commission, Ayers hasn't spoken to Cash since Tuesday night.
Is he staying with you guys?
He's living with Tilda, Maya says.
Living with Tilda? Ayers knew they were kind of seeing each other. They'd been together the afternoon that Mick proposed at Christmas Cove. That was 5 days ago. Now they're living together?
Wow,
Ayers says. The toast won't settle in her stomach. She feels like it's on a seesaw. Is it coming up or staying down?
Where's Baker?
He and Floyd are at the Westin, Maya says. I'm actually headed there in a little while to watch Floyd while Baker looks at some rentals.
You are?
Ayers says. She feels a tiny arrow of optimism shoot through her, though she's too lethargic to even smile.
So they're staying?
Yes, they're staying. Floyd starts at Gift Hill on Monday, Maya says. Wait until I tell everyone he's my nephew.
Oh boy, Ayers thinks. The Gift Hill mothers will have a field day with that.
Have fun, Ayers says. I love you. You're my number one girl. Let's hang out next week.
We can, Maya says, but I might be busy with my friends or babysitting for Floyd.
Right, Ayers says. Only if you can fit me in.
I'll have my people call your people,
Maya says, and she hangs up. Baker is staying. For a second, Ayers' happiness is greater than the dread that she feels about the rest of the story. The lost villa, the FBI, Russ's illegal business dealings. She should tell someone about the journals. It feels like they're smoldering beneath her. But they're personal, private. Rosie wouldn't want anyone to see them. Of that, Ayers is certain. Ayers plans to give them to Maya when she gets older. The FBI knows Russ was laundering money, so the journals wouldn't offer anything new. But what about the mentions of Todd Croft? Was there foul play with the helicopter?
Ah.
Ayers doesn't want to hand the journals over. It's her own private line of communication with Rosie. And if Huck read them, or worse, Irene read them, well, that wouldn't be good. And yet to hide them? No. Ayers has to show someone. She'll show Huck. Or Baker? No, Huck.
I'm sorry, Rosie,
Ayers thinks. And then she races to the bathroom to throw up. Cash.
I'm sure you understand my concerns,
Granger Payne says. Before Cash can respond, Granger dives into the T-shaped pool and powers out 6 laps. Then he lifts himself out of the pool, triceps flexing, and dries his face with one of the fluffy white Turkish towels. Over the past week, Cash has become very familiar with all the luxuries on offer here at Tilda's parents' house in Peter Bay, which is precisely Granger's point.
I do indeed, sir, Cash says.
He's relieved that the Treasure Island is back up and running and that he's dressed for work. Every day for the past few days, while the boat was being repaired, Cash woke up late with Tilda, and over banana pancakes and mango smoothies, they picked a beach or a trail or both to hike. On Tilda's day off, the two of them climbed into Tilda's Range Rover and drove out to Hanson Bay in the East End. They rented a kayak and spent the entire afternoon drinking grapefruit margaritas and eating the sublime tacos, rum rib with chipotle slaw, green chicken curry, at the floating barge restaurant Lime Out. Lime Out had bar seats attached to the barge, which Cash and Tilda sat in before claiming a floating table. They reclined on inflatable chaises, faces to the sun, drinks in hand, toasting the good life, which they were undeniably enjoying. Cash had to actively fight off encroaching guilt. His family had just undergone a huge financial crisis, and what was Cash doing? Drinking cocktails that his brand new girlfriend was paying for with her Black American Express card. Granger wraps the towel around his waist. He's about Cash's size, 5'9 or so, and is in extremely good physical shape. possibly even better shape than Cash, and he's 56 years old. The villa has a full gym with two Peloton bikes. Granger and Tilda's mother, Lauren, get up at 5:30 every morning to ride together, then Granger does his weight regimen, then he swims.
"Want some green juice?"
Granger asks Cash. On the counter of the outdoor kitchen is a carafe of liquid the color of shamrocks. It was most likely put there by Virgie, the housekeeper, who moves around the villa with the stealth of a ninja and who, this past week, has refused to let Cash do so much as take his own dishes to the sink. Guilt. His mother, Baker, Floyd. If they knew how Cash was living, what would they think?
"Sure," Cash says.
He accepts a glass of green juice, takes a sip, and immediately wants to spit it out. It's liquefied kale, he suspects, with maybe a thin slice of apple or one green grape thrown in.
"Lauren and I are very protective, where Tilda is concerned," Granger says. "She tends to show all her cards. She doesn't have much of a poker face, I'm afraid."
Granger gulps down the entire glass of juice, and Cash shivers just watching. He's unsure he can manage even one more sip.
"It's clear how much she likes you. She says you have other places you can go, so it's not like you're using her to avoid becoming homeless."
"Right," Cash says quickly. "That's right, sir."
"Please, call me Granger."
"Granger, sir," Cash says. He can't help it. The sir comes automatically. Granger Payne is a sir as surely as Johnny Cash or Muhammad Ali would be a sir.
"I could move in with my mother or my brother, and I'll do that if it makes you more comfortable."
Here, Cash holds Granger's gaze, willing the older man not to call his bluff. Irene is presently living in Maya's bedroom at Huck's house, and Baker is still at the Westin hemorrhaging $500 a night while he looks for an affordable year-round rental. Cash told Baker that if he found something big enough, Cash would happily move in, share the rent, provide childcare for Floyd.
"Okay," Baker said, "but you'd better have a backup plan."
Cash had initially considered asking Ayers if he could take over her lease, since she had gotten engaged to Mick and would likely move in with him. He wasn't sure how much she paid, but if she could afford it, then he could, right? They worked at the same place. But Ayers had a second very lucrative job waiting tables at La Tapa. Cash would likely need to get a second job as well. He should be looking now instead of goofing off every day with Tilda. The plan of taking over Ayers' place vanished when Tilda came home from La Tapa with the news that Ayers was no longer engaged. She had given the ring back to Mick.
"Stay here for the time being, please," Granger says. "I have to admit, I like the idea of having another man around. Tilda and her mother tend to gang up on me. I could use some support."
"Thank you, sir," Cash says. He needs to excuse himself so Tilda can drive him to work. He's dependent on her for everything, and she has been a total rock star, accommodating him and never making him feel bad.
"I have more than enough privilege for both of us."
"Tilda tells me you used to be in the outdoor supply business in Colorado," Granger says. "What happened?"
"Ah," Cash says. He has any number of responses ready. "I got tired of the cold, the lack of oxygen, the stoner teenagers who worked for me stealing from the register." But he suspects that Granger Payne has run a background check on him and maybe also investigated his credit.
"I blew it. My father bought me the stores and expected me to know how to run them. But I didn't learn how to manage them properly until it was too late. I got behind with the bank and they went under. It was quite a learning experience." "I'm happy to hear you learned something," Granger says, "because I have an exciting business proposition on the horizon, and Tilda is dead set on having you be a part of it. Sweat equity, boots on the ground type of stuff. You're good with people, I can see that, and you seem to have personal integrity." Another man might have lied to me about the stores or tried to blame the failure on someone else.
Cash nods. Integrity he has. It's everything else he's lacking.
How well do you handle unexpected setbacks? Granger asks.
Cash says.
Pretty well. I mean, yeah, my life has been one unexpected setback after another recently, but I'm still standing. So I'd say I can deal with just about whatever life throws at me.
Good, Granger says.
Because although Lauren and I are happy to welcome you with open arms, your dog has to go.
Cash feels like Granger has just taken him into a headlock and is squeezing his windpipe.
Winnie? He squeaks.
Winnie, Granger says. Lauren and I are far too peripatetic to have pets, and the way she decorated the house...
In white, Cash says.
Right, I get it.
He swallows.
We've kept Winnie mostly outside.
Mostly outside won't cut it with my wife, Granger says. And it's not fair to the dog. So best to find another place for her to wait out this time of transition you're in.
Yes, sir, Cash says.
He's saved from breaking down in tears in front of Granger when Tilda honks the horn of the Range Rover.
Steel, let's go, she calls out.
Exactly like her mother, Granger says.
He claps Cash on the arm.
All right, Cash man. Glad we understand each other.
On the steep, twisting drive from Peter Bay to town, Tilda says,
How was the Inquisition?
Most of it was okay. But...
But it was a complete ambush, Tilda says. I know. I'm sorry. They normally text or call to let me know they're coming so I can go to Starfish and get their soy milk or whatever. This is highly unusual. I think after I told them you were staying here, they wanted to catch us unawares.
They succeeded, Cash thinks.
The night before, Tilda got home from La Tapa bearing goodies from the kitchen in to-go boxes. A gorgonzola Caesar, pork belly, and wood-grilled sirloin. They lit the candles on the patio table. Tilda opened a good bottle of Cabernet from Granger's wine collection, the Lael 2016 blueprint, and after she tasted it, she winked at Cash and said,
Notes of fire coral, DEET, and the Tide Pod Challenge.
Good one, Cash said.
Nonsensical wine descriptions had become a verbal tic of Tilda's ex, Skip, the bartender at La Tapa, and Tilda and Cash couldn't stop themselves from riffing on it. They had just picked up their forks to dig in when they heard voices, and Cash, for one panicked moment, feared another FBI raid. Were they coming for him? But then Tilda scooted back her chair and said,
Well, hello, parents. Don't you two look cozy? Lauren Payne said.
She was tall with a slender yoga physique like Tilda, but while Tilda sported a pixie cut, Lauren had long golden brown hair that she'd pulled up in a ponytail. She wore a white linen dress and a pair of leopard print wedge sandals. She was pretty and looked way younger than Cash had expected. Granger followed close on Lauren's heels. He wore a tan suit, white shirt, and no tie. He had his hair slicked back, and reading glasses were perched on top of his head. His handshake was brutal, but somehow Cash had anticipated this and gave his firmest effort, complete with eye contact and smile. On the inside, however, Cash felt his confidence evaporate. Her parents were here. What would they think about Cash moving in? Did they know what had happened to his father? His mother? The optics weren't great. Cash realized this. His father, now dead, had been revealed to have a second family hidden down here, and his sketchy, indeed illegal, business practices had been uncovered. His mother was newly destitute and worked on a fishing boat. It wasn't exactly the platinum pedigree that the elder Paynes no doubt wanted for the romantic partner of their only child. However, the only thing Tilda's parents had objected to in that moment was her opening the 2016 blueprint. Granger fetched two balloon goblets from the crystal cabinet. Tilda and Cash were drinking the wine out of regular tumblers, and poured wine for himself and Lauren. Then they retreated to the master wing, which was so far from Tilda's wing that it was like a separate house. When Cash asked how much Tilda's parents knew about his situation, she said, "I tell my mother everything, and she tells my dad."
"And do they care?"
"Granger will probably have questions in the morning," Tilda said. But neither Tilda nor Cash had thought about the dog. "So most of it was okay," Tilda says now, "but not all of it?" Cash thinks back to the first time Tilda brought him to the Peter Bay Villa. Tilda and Cash were caring for Tilda's very drunk friend Max, and Cash had noticed the villa's terrifyingly white furnishings because he was afraid Max might vomit on them. And then later at dinner, Tilda told Cash she volunteered to walk dogs at the shelter because her parents wouldn't let her get a dog of her own. But Tilda hadn't balked for even one second about Cash bringing Winnie with him, though she did suggest Winnie stay only in Tilda's wing of the house. The line about Winnie living mostly outside was a lie. And Virgie, the housekeeper, had seemed not only unbothered by Winnie, but downright delighted by her. She had even brought Winnie treats.
"Your dad told me Winnie has to go," Cash says.
They have reached the parking lot across from Mongoose Junction. Tilda pulls in. "I was afraid of that."
"I'm not sure what to do," Cash says.
"Your mom?" Tilda says. "Baker?"
"Maybe," Cash says.
Baker is at a hotel, so the answer is no, or not yet. His mother?
Arr.
She loves Winnie, but she's a guest herself, just like Cash. He manufactures a smile.
"I'll figure something out. Can you come pick me up at 4? If not, I'll hitch."
"If you think I'm going to let someone else pick you up, you're crazy," she says, and she leans over for a kiss.
"Thank you," Cash says.
"You're not allowed to thank me."
"I know, but I want you to know that I'm grateful. The timing on all of this was so bad. Our relationship is still so new, and you've done so much."
"All I've really done is save you from pining after heirs," Tilda says. "I told my mother you used to have a crush on her."
"You did not," Cash says. "Why did you do that? It wasn't even a thing."
"It was a thing," Tilda says, "but it's over now."
"Over before it began," Cash says. "Please don't tell me you're worried about heirs."
"She's newly single," Tilda says, shrugging, "and you're with her every day." Cash takes Tilda's face in his hands. He did have quite an intense crush on Ayers when he first got down here. He and Baker both did. But she ended up with Mick, and Cash's feelings for her vanished as quickly as they'd appeared. He can still see she's attractive, but all he feels for her is a brotherly fondness.
"I like you," Cash says.
He looks into Tilda's hazel eyes. She's so young, and yet so self-possessed and clear-headed and unspoiled despite her parents' wealth.
"You'd better."
"I do."
"I feel bad about Winnie," Tilda says, "but my parents will not be moved on the topic of a dog. I'm so sorry." She kisses him again. "See you at 4.
What is he going to do about Winnie? What is he going to do?
He feels unreasonably angry at Tilda's parents. Winnie is such a good dog, the best of dogs. She's more human than dog. They would realize that if they took the time to get to know her.
"My parents will not be moved on the topic of a dog."
"It's their villa, they make the rules, and they aren't bad people just because they aren't dog people. What Cash is angry about is that he has no power. He's at the mercy of others."
Peripatetic.
Cash Googles it. Of or relating to traveling or moving frequently. In particular, working or based in various places for short periods. Synonyms: nomadic, itinerant.
Fortunately or unfortunately, there's no time to ruminate on the situation with Winnie. Treasure Island has a completely full charter today since the boat has been out of commission for over a week, and the first person Cash sees is the captain, James, who does not look happy. James is 6'6", West Indian, and though he's only a little older than Cash, Cash thinks of him as a sir. It's 7:30 on the dot, so being late isn't the issue, though there's already a line of passengers waiting to check in, including a group of 40-something women who, Cash can tell, are ready for a good time. He thinks back to the charter when he babysat Tilda's drunk friend Max and decides then and there that he's not opening the bar until the snorkeling part of their trip is over.
"Hey, bruh,"
James says, and he shakes Cash's hand.
"Ayers isn't coming. She called in sick."
"Called in sick?"
"Yeah, bruh. So you're on your own today."
James glances over at the group of women who are making no secret of checking out James and Cash. "Good luck." Cash can't believe Ayers called in sick on their first day back. She had all of last week to be sick. He wonders if maybe sick has something to do with her broken engagement. Maybe she's depressed? Should Cash be worried? He'll text her later. Right now, he has to check in 27 people, record their passport information, since they're heading to the British Virgin Islands, and collect their money. Mr. and Mrs. Bellhorn from Coral Gables would like to talk to Cash about getting a partial refund since the boat's mechanical issues pushed this trip back 5 days, which was quite an inconvenience. The phrase "partial refund" spreads like a virus. Everyone in line starts to repeat it because every single person, except for the group of women who are from Wichita, Kansas, was originally scheduled to come a different day. Cash nearly makes a stern announcement that he isn't the person who handles refunds, and if they want to explore that possibility, they need to call the office. But then he realizes that without Ayers, he has an opportunity to shine. And by shine, he means make some serious tip money. In an instant, his attitude changes. He's not going to be grouchy Cash who has been left to do the paperwork and make the breakfast and wash the snorkel equipment and check the lines and make sure no one goes overboard and give the historical and ecological details of the Virgin Islands by himself. He is going to be warm, funny, solicitous, helpful Cash. He is going to go out of his way to ensure this is the best charter these 27 people have ever been on.
"This is the number for the main office," Cash says, sliding Mr. and Mrs. Bellhorn a card. "You want to ask for Whitney. I certainly hope she offers you a partial refund, though of course I can't guarantee it. I'm very sorry about the inconvenience. I'm a planner myself, and I do appreciate your patience."
Cash smiles. The Bellhorns smile back. "Okay then, next." Somehow Cash gets it done. Everyone present, documented, paid up, and on board enjoying the fruit platter and the coconut banana bread. People are applying sunscreen. Cash puts on Kenny Chesney's Get Along. The ladies from Wichita belt out, "We ain't perfect, but we try." That's Cash's motto today as well. No matter that he's flying solo, no matter that he's been on this job only a few weeks, no matter that his father is dead and his mother broke and his dog homeless. He's in the Caribbean. The turquoise water is smooth and the emerald green islands create an artistic landscape. He doesn't want to leave St. John ever. He needs to find someone to take Winnie, at least for a while. He needs to find a way to make his life work. Granger has a business proposition on the horizon that Tilda wants Cash involved in. Yes, Tilda has been talking ambitiously about opening a business, adventure ecotourism, which would be right in Cash's wheelhouse, boots on the ground, sweat equity. He doesn't have to front any money, he just has to show up. Cash wishes that on the horizon meant next week or even tomorrow.
Cash is the only crew member, and James thinks the planned itinerary, a trip to the baths, snorkeling at the Indians, and then 2 hours of merrymaking on Yost Van Dyke, will be too much for Cash to handle alone. Instead, James says, they're going to Smuggler's Cove on the western tip of Tortola, followed by stops at Sandy Spit and Willie T's.
Oh, man, Cash says. Are you sure about that? I've never been to any of those places.
They'll snorkel first thing in Smuggler's Cove, James says. There's a beautiful beach and they can have lunch at Nigel's. Then back on the boat to Sandy Spit, then Willie T's for an hour, then home.
James starts the engine, trust me. What choice does Cash have? He's afraid the passengers will rise up in protest. Not only have many of them had this trip rescheduled, but now they're not even going where they were supposed to go. They aren't going to the baths on Virgin Gorda, which is an experience like no other. And they aren't going to the world-famous Soggy Dollar. He expects a mutiny. But then he gets an idea. He heads up to the top deck where the 9 women from Wichita are sitting. Midwesterners are nice. They're helpful. Cash knows this because he is one. When Cash checked the women in, Christine, Stephanie, Kelly, Amy, Jennifer P., Jennifer A., Michelle, Tracy, and Donna, he learned that it was Donna's 50th birthday. Over their bathing suits, the women all wore navy t-shirts that read, Donna, do you wanna? Which Christine told him was a private joke. Ladies, Cash says, I need a favor. He tells them what the favor is, and they fall all over themselves, assuring him that they've got his back. He's so cute, he's so hot, they say, and all they want in return are some pictures with him for their Instagrams and a promise that he'll hold Donna's hand as she jumps off the Willie T. Michelle read on TripAdvisor that jumping off the Willie T is a bucket list item, which is news to Cash.
Yes, I will. I got you, Cash says. Thank you, ladies.
Cash gets ready to announce the change of itinerary over the microphone. It's his first time wearing the headset, and he has to admit, he kind of likes the authority.
The captain is allowing us a rare and exciting opportunity today, ladies and gentlemen, Cash says. We're heading over to Smuggler's Cove on Tortola, where we will snorkel in the crystal clear water, and then you'll have ample time to enjoy the secluded white sand beach. If you'd like lunch and cocktails, you can visit Nigel's Boom Boom for a taste of the authentic Caribbean. When we leave Smuggler's Cove, we'll swing by Sandy Spit for a terrific photo op. We'll end our day at the world-famous Willie T's, a decommissioned freighter that has been reimagined as a beach bar mecca. How does that sound to everyone? From the top deck comes the sound of ecstatic screaming, and everyone looks up to see Donna, Christine, and company jumping up and down as though they've just been picked as contestants on The Price is Right. The other passengers do high fives and cheer like they can't believe their good fortune. Cash relaxes. He's good at this. James is right. This itinerary is extremely easy for Cash to manage, even alone. They arrive in Smuggler's Cove in just half an hour. The beach is a crescent of white sand fringed by palms, and it's deserted, as though it has been ordered up and is waiting just for them. James asks Cash to drop the anchor, and then he runs through the snorkel spiel. Defog your mask with this simple solution of dish soap and